Our guest today on Meet the Press is Professor Zbigniew Brzezinski, director of the Research Institute on Communist Affairs at Columbia University and a widely recognized expert on the communist world. He's a former member of the State Department Policy Planning Council. We'll have the first questions now from Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Professor Brzezinski, President Nixon clearly indicated that he seeks that to end confrontation and to enter an era of negotiation with the Soviet Union. Have you seen any convincing indication that the Soviet Union is ready for an end to confrontation and for real, meaningful negotiation?
Well, I think the Soviet Union has a diversified foreign policy, as we do. In some respects, the Soviet Union, I think, at the present moment, is interested in diminishing the level of tension on its western flank, in part because of the Sino-Soviet threat. I think the Soviet Union has some interest, as we do, in controlling the arms race. So I think there are some limited areas in which negotiations can begin. But more generally, I would say that it would be a mistake for us to assume that we can resolve all of the problems of the world purely on a bilateral basis with the Soviet Union.
Well, now, what does the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia tell you about their intentions towards the West and to us and towards their general attitude about confrontation?
Well, I think the Soviet occupation of Czechoslovakia shows Soviet determination to hang on to Eastern Europe and to perpetuate the division of Europe. The kind of settlement the Soviet Union would like at the present moment is a settlement which would perpetuate the division of Western Europe, the division of Europe, perhaps create the preconditions for divisions in the West, and at the same time to assure itself somewhat of its Western flank.
What do you think the Soviet Union today really wants from a summit meeting?
From the summit meeting, I should think the Soviet Union would want the creation of the impression that a bilateral American-Soviet accommodation is at hand, that the two superpowers are prepared to view the world essentially as their domain to be controlled by the two of them. Perhaps some accommodation, as I said, in the field of the arms control, in the field of the arms race. And beyond that, I suppose diminution of pressures for liberalization, for accommodation on the East-West front in Europe, which the Soviet Union fears. Mr. Spivak, as I look at our policy towards the Soviet Union, what frightens me the most is the fear that perhaps we will move simultaneously towards a bilateral deal with the Soviet Union and at the same time some sort of sidling up to General de Gaulle. Because I think the effect of the two things combined would achieve for the Soviets the perpetuation of a more cohesive position in the East and at the same time stimulate divisions in the West. And this would be the worst possible bargain for us.
Professor, there are many anti-communists who insist that there is little point in making an agreement with the Soviet Union because they have broken so many agreements in the past. How do you feel about that?
I don't agree with that. It seems to me that all major powers reach agreements on the basis of their felt interest at a given time. When that felt interest declines, they move away from the agreement. All powers act that way. So do we, incidentally. And I think the point of an agreement is to find an area of common interest which the agreement then crystallizes and expresses. And I think it behooves us to search for these areas of agreement with the Soviet Union, but without exaggerated hopes, without exaggerated expectations.
Thank you, gentlemen. Resuming our interview, our guest today on Meet the Press is Professor Zbigniew Brzezinski of Columbia University, an expert on communist affairs. You've just met Lawrence Spivak. The other reporters on our panel today are Peter Gross of the New York Times, William R. Fry of the World and Focus Syndicate, and Ellie Abel of NBC News. We'll continue the questions with Mr. Gross.
Dr. Brzezinski, speaking no longer as a government official, but with the conceptual purity of the academic world, I wonder if you could put yourself in the minds of the men in the Kremlin. The Nixon and the Johnson administrations tell us that the Russians really will help us in the last analysis in Vietnam. Now, if they realize that we don't intend to let this war broaden into a general war, why should they help us?
Well, Mr. Gross, this is an issue of some contention, and I can only speak from my own position. My view has been that the Soviet Union, in the course of the last 2 years, has not been interested in ending the war in Vietnam. It has been interested in avoiding that war expanding, escalating, or perhaps even in avoiding a situation in which a more radical, more pro-Chinese version would emerge victorious. But within those parameters, I think it was in the interest of the Soviet Union for the war to continue. It was contributing to a diminution of the United States' position in Europe. It was hurting our efforts on the East-West Front. It was doing the things we know that happened at home. Now, I do believe in the last 6 months there's been some change in the Soviet posture, in the sense that I do believe that in the last 6 months the Soviet Union has begun to say to the North Vietnamese and to the Southern allies, begin to get the Americans to get out. Negotiate so that you begin the process of disengagement, because then you can win the struggle politically. Now, in that sense, you could argue they have been helping us because they have been talking to the North Vietnamese in terms of getting them to talk to us. But it's still for a different end than the end that we would presumably wish to achieve in the course of the talks. And it should be remembered that the Soviet Union is supplying about 80% of the war material currently used by the other side in Vietnam.
Well, let me ask the same question about the Middle East. Why should the Russians want to reduce tensions there, tensions that give them secure allies in a large part of the world, the Arab land?
Well, I think the situation in the Middle East is somewhat different in the sense that it is not in the Soviet interest for hostilities again to take place. If hostilities were to take place, I think it's quite certain that the Arab states would get beaten very badly by the Israelis. And this is hardly in the Soviet interest. Therefore, as I read the Soviet interest in the Middle East, it is to avoid hostilities. It is perhaps to get a settlement if it improves the Soviet political position in the region. If not, in any case, it is to prevent hostilities from renewing.
Mr. Fry.
Mr. Brzezinski, on this particular Sunday of all the days in the year, we look for signs of hope or a fresh promise. As you look around the world, do you see any realistic basis for such hope? Vietnam and the Middle East, you've mentioned. What about Soviet-American relations or European settlement?
Well, I think if you look at the world in terms of specific events, there isn't too much hope. But if you look at the world in a more broad historical perspective, I think we are moving towards a community of nations which will become more cooperative in time. I believe we are moving in the direction of ending the ideological civil war that has divided the developed world for the last 150 years. I think we are moving in the direction of larger perspectives, diminution of tension, avoidance of violence. We have preserved the peace between the developed nations for almost 25 years now. This is pretty good. I do believe the scale of violence is declining already. I do believe that on all sides of the barricades, there's a recognition of the fact that you cannot any longer rely on war. And eventually, I believe that this country itself, because of the transition it is experiencing at home, will begin to move in the direction of trying to build a community of the developed nations, which will involve not only the West Europeans, not only the Japanese, but even the Russians and the East Europeans, and on that basis create a hard core of a more stable international system.
How high do you rate the possibility of a Russian-Chinese war in the next 5 years?
An open war in the sense of unmitigated hostility, not very high. A protracted series of border conflicts, somewhat reminiscent of the Soviet-Japanese-Manchurian border conflict in the mid-30s, quite high.
Mr. Abel.
Mr. Brzezinski, I believe you are fond of broad historical perspectives. Let me throw this one at you. We are about to celebrate in Washington this week the 20th anniversary of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The Warsaw Pact is not much younger, as you know. As you look at Europe and this East-West confrontation, what do you see? Do you see 20 more years of block facing block with a quarter of a million or more Americans tied down more or less permanently in Europe?
I think it depends very much, Mr. Abel, on what we do. If we try to reach an accommodation with the Soviet Union on the basis of the division of Europe, and if simultaneously we betray those in England and Germany and Italy who are pressing for a more united Europe, but really begin to accept the Gaullist idea of a dispersed, diffuse Western Europe, then I think this kind of division of Europe that you have spoken about will continue. If instead we remain true to our commitment of a more united Europe with which we will eventually become more and more associated, and at the same time link that to a broadly gauged effort to build new links spanning the East-West division of Europe, political, economic, security links, the creation of a European Security Commission, something which I have proposed a year ago to link NATO and the Warsaw Pact, then I believe we can begin to end that partition of Europe while at the same time creating more stable unity both in the West and indirectly also in the East.
We've had so many indications in recent years that the Europeans cannot unify themselves, even in Western Europe. Are you saying that we, the United States, ought to take over this job? How can we bring them together so long as de Gaulle sits at the Élysée Palace and says no?
No, that would be a great mistake for us to try to take it over. We can't do it. But I think we ought to remain committed to the idea of a united Europe and hope that the thrust which has been generated by European economic integration, by the creation of a more European-oriented youth, will continue, especially after the general departs from the palace, which will happen at some point, and especially in view of the greater inclination of the English and the Germans to press for a united Europe.
You recall, Mr. Brzezinski, how close we were last summer to opening strategic arms limitation talks with the Russians. Then Prague happened and made that impossible. What about now? How soon, how urgent is it that we go ahead with the Russians now?
Well, how soon, of course, depends on how well we are prepared, how well the Russians are prepared. I take it we are not yet ready really to talk in a prepared way about this extraordinarily complicated problem. We are dealing with a divided, I would even say paralyzed, leadership in the Kremlin. So this, too, is a factor that has to be taken into account. But in my view, we ought to be moving as rapidly as possible because the arms race is not waiting. And I think there is a particularly good opportunity today, given the kind of problems the Soviets have with China, given the kind of difficulties that they're facing in Czechoslovakia, for us to take the initiative and not only to propose arms talks, but to propose a general conference on the European problem. Let not the other side always take the initiative in these fields. Let us take the initiative, and let us say it's time to talk about a general discussion. Let's have a general discussion of the European problem 20 years after the end of the war.
Mr. Spivak.
Professor Brzezinski, after the invasion of Czechoslovakia, you wrote that it is important to deter the Soviet Union from further use of force in Europe. Just how would you do that?
Deterrence involves not only military pressure, but also political initiative. It seemed to me that even prior to the Soviet occupation of Czechoslovakia, if we had taken initiatives designed to launch East-West talks, security and political, we might have made it more difficult for the Soviet Union to act unilaterally as she did.
Well, what do you think the United States can do today to defer them from action, say, against Tito or against Romania, or from further action against Czechoslovakia? Anything?
Well, I think in the case of the Romanians and the Yugoslavs, we have made it very clear that if those two countries were invaded and they fought, that this would create an entirely different situation in Europe, one wrought with unpredictable consequences. Insofar as Czechoslovakia is concerned, I think we could aid the Czechs by doing the things which I have spoken a few minutes ago about, namely, take broad East-West initiatives in Europe. If we were to take such initiatives, I think we would indicate...
What does that mean?
Propose, for example, a European political security conference. Accept the other side's proposal to have one. Propose new spanning bodies, such as a European Security Commission, to create a new link between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. In other words, make it very clear that our long-range objective is not to undermine the Soviet bloc, not to undermine the communist regimes in Eastern Europe, not to isolate the Soviet Union, but to create new binding relationships with them, which then diminish the temptation, as well as the fear, of the Soviet conservatives to act the way they have acted and the way they still may act in Czechoslovakia.
Professor Brzezinski, based upon your studies, would you say that the Soviet Union genuinely fears the United States and arms to protect herself, or that she believes she may one day be able to conquer the United States by a sudden nuclear strike?
Well, I don't think one excludes the other. But I would doubt that at the present moment, the Soviet leadership was geared to making preparations for some hypothetical X day in the future on which it would launch a preemptive first strike against the United States. I can see Soviet military planners considering this, among other alternatives, as something that has to be taken into account. But I would doubt that a political leadership, such as the Soviet, particularly divided political leadership, could conclude today that 7 years from now it will launch a preemptive first strike against the United States and base its strategic planning on that basis.
Professor, do you think that the Soviet Union has strengthened herself in Europe by the invasion of Czechoslovakia, or that this is only an indication of her insecurity and that actually she may well have weakened herself?
I think it's the latter. I think she has weakened herself, and I think we could exploit that weakness, not in a Cold War fashion, but in a positive fashion, to translate it into something positive by taking the initiative on the East-West front and not dealing, as I have said several times in this program already, purely bilaterally with the Soviets on some specific issues, and then concentrate purely on the remilitarization of NATO on the one hand, and at the same time put into the shadows, into the background, our commitment to West European unity.
Mr. Gross.
Well, Dr. Brzezinski, what would be the effect on our relations with the Soviet Union and with the rest of Europe if we were successful in establishing some kind of working relationship over the next few years with communist China?
Well, that's very hypothetical. I don't, frankly, expect we'll have a working relationship with communist China in the next few years. At the same time, I have changed my mind on American-Chinese relations. In the past, I felt that we shouldn't move too rapidly towards China because this would create in the Soviet Union the view that we're operating essentially on Cold War basis. It seems to me that today there is no harm in reminding the Soviet Union that, after all, it too has a stake in better relations on the East-West front. And thus, it is now my view that we ought to try to improve our relations with each and thereby more effectively promote our interests vis-à-vis both. But in doing so, I don't think we ought to be talking about things which really require Chinese cooperation and Chinese abandonment of what they consider to be their fundamental rights. For example, the issue of diplomatic relationships or United Nations membership immediately raises the question of Formosa. I would much rather propose to the Chinese, for example, a Peking-Washington hotline in view of the fact that they are now a nuclear power. This doesn't involve diplomatic relationships. This doesn't involve the question of recognition. This doesn't involve the question of the United Nations. Or lift the embargo on trade and travel. Try to take actions which obviate, which bypass present political difficulties.
So you feel that it is possible for an American administration to attempt to play both sides, to work toward the Chinese at the same time as preserving the better atmosphere that has developed with Moscow?
Well, I wouldn't call it playing both sides. I would say that there's no reason why the United States should not put itself in the same position as the Soviet Union vis-à-vis the two other powers. The Soviet Union maintains relations with both. We ought to try to develop some sort of a relationship with the one that we have no relationship with at all today.
Do you consider a reversion to a Stalinist type of leadership in the Soviet Union, either under Chinese pressure or under internal pressures, to be a practical possibility for the 1970s?
Not a Stalinist type leadership, Mr. Gross, but something quite different from Stalin, but no less unappealing. Namely, I do believe there is a tendency today in the Soviet Union, which perhaps the Sino-Soviet crisis might intensify, for the Soviet political system to be gradually transformed from a political communist dictatorship into a para-communist military dictatorship. Namely, the amalgam of the military, who are very conservative nationalistically and ideologically, with established party bureaucracy. And such an amalgam, emphasizing nationalism and ideology, deriving emotional support from the masses on the grounds of national security, could, I think, be quite a formidable neighbor.
Mr. Fry.
Well, this interests me very much. Would you go a little bit more deeply into the subject? You mentioned, for example, that you described the present leadership in the Kremlin as divided and paralyzed. Would you tell us who are the hawks, the principal hawks, who are the principal doves, and is the balance between them as delicate as we've been told?
Well, I, first of all, don't like the division of collective leaderships into two groups any more than I like the application of hawks and doves to, let's say, discussion of internal Washington affairs. I think there are many more fluid constellations which range and form themselves differently over domestic and international issues. If you want a kind of dichotomic division of the Politburo into two groups, I suppose the conventional wisdom is that Kosygin is a dove, that on some issues pertaining to Czechoslovakia, even Suslov was, because he was concerned about the unity of the international communist movement, I would say that Brezhnev and some of the more professional party apparatchiki are more hardline. But all of this has to be qualified by the proposition that these constellations change and shift depending on issues.
About 3.5 minutes left, gentlemen. Mr. Fry?
Well, all right. Then just one brief question about our overall strategy. You said in an answer to a question of one of my earlier questions, that you didn't expect any major blow-up between Russia and China. But suppose the tensions between them became somewhat more extreme, to the point where there was a great temptation for us to exploit the opportunity. What would you do in Eastern Europe to take advantage of it?
I would pursue the policy which I've spoken about, namely creating positive options for individual communist states and for all of the European communist states to become more positively related to the West. It seems to me that the long-range historical thrust, both of their internal development and of the Sino-Soviet conflict, is to push them westward. It behooves us, it seems to me, to have an open-ended policy designed to forge as many links as soon as possible with these communist states, especially if the process gets accelerated by the Sino-Soviet dispute.
Mr. Abel?
Brzezinski, the President has spoken of trying to link progress on disarmament with progress on Vietnam, the Middle East, other political issues. Does this strike you as a practical, realistic approach to negotiating with Russia in 1969?
It strikes me as a practical, realistic point of departure for the negotiations. And if the point of departure then were to lead to more substantive progress, then I, for one, would not insist on as iron-clad arms agreed as there otherwise might. In other words, if there is progress in a variety of political fields, I think we can be less insistent on a highly, highly specific, highly controlled arms control agreement. If there is no progress on political issues, then I think the arms control arrangements will have to be far more sophisticated, far more complex, far more contrived, and probably far more difficult to achieve.
But how, in fact, does this work? Do you hold up talks on arms control while you wait for an agreement to be worked out on pacifying the Middle East, or what?
No, you have a series of parallel talks. We do have, after all, talks in the Middle East and the United Nations. We'll have bilateral American talks on arms control. We can have a series of other talks and other issues going on at the same time.
About 1 minute, gentlemen. Mr. Spivak.
Professor Brzezinski, when you were in the State Department under President Johnson, you were known as a hardliner on Vietnam. What do you think we ought to do today about Vietnam in order to further peace?
Well, first of all, I was a hardliner only in the sense that I believed it was necessary for the United States to preserve the stability of Southeast Asia. Today, I believe we have achieved that objective. I think we ought to announce a standstill ceasefire on the grounds that we believe that we ought to talk and not kill at the same time. And if there is no agreement on mutual troop withdrawals, we ought to begin to move out sometime in the fall or winter on a graduated basis.
What do you mean by a standstill ceasefire? You mean we should simply stop shooting?
That's right.
Regardless of what the enemy does?
No, invite the other side to stop shooting too. Retaliate if the other sides insist on firing, but try to create a situation in which we are the ones who are terminating the fighting while the negotiations are going on.
Actually, to announce that we're going to stop and stop and wait?
Right.
You'd be for that?
Yes.
You'd take that kind of a risk?
I would take that risk, as we have taken a risk in suspending the bombing, which I favored. I favor the suspension.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is up. Thank you, Professor Brzezinski, for being with us today on Meet the Press.